It's the Islamic Bomb Edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, Pray to Death, Religious Intolerance on the Rise, Iran and the Bomb, and the Black Death. Let's begin episode 183.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical. The cosmos is also within us. We're made of sparks. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others. We've traveled this way before. And there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your free thinking historian.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher. Ethan, there's been like a number of really, really heart-wrenching stories in the news. I don't know if you've been following, but the Supreme Court refused to hear a particular case about child abuse that was done in the name of religion, Islam this time in Canada, which is a little unusual. Essentially, you know, they pulled the plug, they let her die. But it struck me as so sad that apparently the main reason why this girl and this family, because it wasn't just the one girl, it was the whole family that had sort of suffered, was because the parents were like really fundamentalist with regards to their religious beliefs. And they starved their children, they beat their children, all because of some religious ideal.
Well, I guess the theme of today's show might be the, negative side, I suppose, the what's the harm side of pseudoscience and fundamentalism. So, fair warning, this news may ruin your day. Recently, there was another example of, what's the harm destroying lives. Two parents have escaped jail time after they allowed their 16-year-old son to die from a burst appendix. Russell and Brandy Bellew, aged 39 and 36, of Creswell, Oregon, pleaded guilty to criminal negligence homicide on Tuesday and were sentenced to 5 years probation, after reaching a plea deal with prosecutors. The Bellows are members of the General Assembly and the Church of the Firstborn in the nearby Pleasant Hill, which shuns modern medicine, teaches that faith healing and prayer will cure disease. So these two, and I'm going to call them idiots, so apologies to idiots everywhere for lumping you in with the Bellows. Anyway, these two idiots allowed their son to die in horrible agony after having appendicitis for a week, which results in terrible abdominal pain that normally requires morphine to control. And this can usually be cured with routine surgery. However, untreated, the inflamed organ will burst and spew bile into the body, which results in dangerous infections that often prove deadly. And unfortunately, that was the case in this young man. The couple were charged with second-degree manslaughter after authorities learned that the young man's death could have been prevented if his parents had simply taken him to a hospital. Social workers have removed the other children, who ranged in age of infants to a 17-year-old, and have placed them in foster care. Hopefully, they'll be kept as far away from their parents as possible. Now, I mean, how on earth these people could escape jail time baffles me. It's another sad example of how pseudoscience and fundamentalism are dangerous. It kills people. I mean, this is the harm that we're constantly talking about on this show. It's just really sad to think that this young man could have grown up and done something with his life if he had been born to parents who had the ability to think critically and skeptically examine the world. I mean, this is the year 2012. People shouldn't be dying of appendicitis anymore.
No, you know, and I totally agree with you on that point. I mean, It seems so bizarre that we allow religion to be sort of this literally get out of jail free card in this particular science. I am kind of curious that maybe one of the reasons why they did the plea deal was that they were worried that if this went to a jury trial, that people may have said, oh, well, it's part of the religious freedoms, and they would have got off scot-free without any kind of conviction. at least in the one way, and I'm trying to put as much of a positive spin as I can in this horrible sort of story, that one of the reasons why they let this plea deal go through is the law still stands, whereas if that had been challenged, it may have seemed to be a restriction of one's freedom of religion.
Yeah, that could be true. And I mean, given if they were in a community that was heavily religious, that they could have gotten away with it. I mean, one would hope that the, you know, outrage that we feel about this would have also impacted the jurors to, you know, not allow them to play the religion card. But I mean, who knows what would have happened? It's just so frustrating, you know. I mean, like, the idea that this can happen in this day and age. I mean, this is, it's not like they're in, like, you know, hillbilly territory. This is Oregon. Like, this isn't that far from us. And this is happening. It's just disgusting.
You know, and it also raises that bizarre idea that somehow children are seen as the property of their parents and in an odd way are allowed to do almost anything they want to it, even if what they do is, I mean, literally this case, fatal to their children. I'd be curious to know how such an incident would be taken care of here in Canada. I suspect, of course, you know, on the one hand, the child would die anyway, because, I mean, we can't police the bedrooms of every place. So someone who gets appendicitis, it's not like you know that beforehand. But you get other cases where, you know, children suffer from sort of long-lasting diseases and their parents allow them to suffer because they have this primitive, more than medieval belief that prayer will cure anything, when it's been proven time and time again. I mean, this is one of the cases where you can put in factual sort of data that even a religious person, even if you believe in God, you know, how many times has someone prayed away appendicitis? Zero times, you know?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's the thing with Canada. I mean, I think that Canada's a bit more forward thinking on the rights of children. I mean, I'm thinking back to when we talked about corporal punishment. I think that Canada has stricter laws that do not necessarily, you know, classify children as property as much as some other states do. But I actually don't know. We'd have to look at some case history for that.
So, you know, Ethan, I'd like to say that, you know, that this is an isolated event, but it seems like it may be a growing trend. Quite often in skepticism, we like to say, you know, hey, we're making the world a much less religious place, but it seems that religious oppression is on the rise. In a recent study released by the Pew Forum on Religion in Public Life, it showed that religious intolerance is on the increase around the world, and more so in the Middle East. The report itself covered from a period of mid-2007 to mid-2010. It covered things like government restriction and social hostility across almost 200 countries. Now, things like government restrictions included things from simple governmental favoritism, limits of religious conversions, all the way up to sort of bans on religious groups and their worship, as well as wearing religious symbols. So think of France in that particular case. The idea of social hostility included things like domination of the public life. Again, think the U.S. atheist U.S. president, but also included harassment for things like dress code, as well as overt violence, you know, mob violence, and even armed conflict. Now, things do not look good. A number of countries that qualified as very highly restricted almost doubled since 2007. Only 47% of the countries showed that actually restrictions were being lessened, whereas in 2007, it was almost 60 countries that were becoming less intolerant places to live. If we look at the best and the worst countries, so those ones that had changed the most, either up or down, you get a 9% versus 2%, with the 9% being countries becoming very, very much more restrictive than they were beforehand. If we kind of look at the data from a regional point of view, we see that on a scale of 1 to 10, I hate to say this because it's a bit prejudicial, but the Americas are the least restrictive, with a median score of 1.2, Sub-Saharan Africa 1.9, Europe 2.3, Asia Pacific 3.4, and the most restrictive being the Middle East at 5.8. This is mirrored in the whole social hostility data, with the Middle East scoring 4.3, Europe 2.2, and the Americas 0.4. I thought it was quite interesting in an intellectual sort of sense, that Europe is not an extreme sort of religious oppressor, but they seem to be consistent, that government reflects very much what the society is doing. Individual religions are also sort of not treated equally as well. It seems, at least on a global scale, Christians who claim that they're being persecuted may actually kind of have a point. They seem to be the most victimized group for both government restrictions in about 95 countries and in social harassment, 77. Muslims come close. They have 74 and 64. And of course, let's not forget the Jews who, unlike the previous group, only suffer government restrictions in 21 countries, but they suffer harassment in 64. So again, it looks like there's a lot more social bias for the one group, whereas the other ones seem to be the main brunt of it. Now, I do think in some ways the data is possibly skewed. The Middle East is a social political thing and not an actual geographical entity. As such, it could be argued that some regions, notably Africa and Asia, are sort of underrepresented because certain key states have been removed from their base. Another confounding factor is the political structure. Obviously, government style will affect government restrictions. A number of these countries have suffered under brutal dictatorship, and churches have traditionally been the loci for political organization. So a significant focus of the government restrictions, not so much because of religious motivation, but political motivation. Another confoundational sort of aspect of this is many elites will attempt to divide and conquer. So they'll sort of inflame sectarian disputes and agitation so that the people are sort of fighting against themselves and sort of ignoring the government over top. Have you had a chance to look at this report, Ethan?
Well, you know, I haven't had a detailed look at it, but the one thing that does jump to mind, I mean, the Pew Forum, they are an American-based organization, are they not?
They are.
Yeah. I mean, not that I'm calling into question their data, so to speak, but it is a little bit interesting how America ranks really high in terms of tolerance. In addition, Christians and Christianity is deemed like the most persecuted religion. I mean, there might be a bit of bias there in that reporting. I don't know. I have a little bit of trouble buying that one, considering that the level of affluence of Christian nations is quite high.
Well, to be fair, that was the median score, not for America, but the Americas. The actual data in the United States, which I guess won't come as a surprise to some of us, is their social hostility score is actually 3.4, and their government restriction score is actually 2.7. Now, to put this into contrast, a country like Egypt would be closer to like 8 or so on this scale. So it's not as bad as them, but it's very definitely the underreported part of the Americas. And actually, surprisingly, a lot of the reports of religious restrictions, be it government or social harassment, lay in the idea, of course, can you guess which group are suffer the most, Ethan? Take a wild guess.
With the Christians?
No, actually, it's Muslims in the United States. That most of the incidents that they report in the United States for harassment and for violence tend to be people of the Islamic faith, although there have been a number of what we might refer to as separation of church and state sort of issues. One of the examples they had used was a Christian school in Colorado that wanted to expand, but the local school board refused to, but gave a permit to a secular school in its stead. And, you know, again, one may argue that that's a good thing, and I think I would, because, you know, church and state schools should be considered part of the state, and there should be a divide between the line. But they argued that based on religious freedoms and particular laws that deal with religious land use and institutional personal act of 2000, whatever that is, allow them to not be discriminated in this way. So it is a bit of a skewed in that regard.
Yeah, that's my thought. I mean, if they're counting sort of a basic tenets of secularism as harassment or infringing on their right to proselytize and expand, then that would definitely skew the data.
No, and that's what I was thinking largely. I mean, if we remember in our last show, we talked about the idea of blasphemy laws. Now, above and beyond blasphemy laws being some way to enforce a particular religion, it also becomes a mechanism for oppressing the other religion. So you get the double whammy on that. And Pakistan is one of the countries that have been very much increasing in that direction of government regulation. One of the highlights they had pointed out, though, was a country like Turkey, which, as a devout atheist, I find a bit more disturbing in the one sense, because they now have a overtly religious leader as they're in the government. But in order to do that, they actually had to rescind a lot of religious restricting laws that prevented religious people from running in government. I mean, in an odd sort of way, that's actually a very interesting question. I mean, part of this is restrictions on religion. And both you and I strongly believe that there should be, you know, a lot of restrictions on religion, at least in particular areas. And in that sense, I think we would be promoting the negative aspect that this article is putting forward.
Well, I mean, I don't know if we're necessarily promoting restrictions on religion, but we're opposing religious privilege in areas where they really don't need or have any right to. I mean, if we're talking about access to politics and policy, religion really has no reason to have privileged access to those services. So, I mean, if they're counting non-access to policy-making power as a restriction on their rights, well, that's a pretty biased way of posing the question.
And I think that goes into, again, another confounding factor, is that, you know, religion should not be given an carte blanche acceptance everywhere. We believe, and I think justifiably so, that there are areas of aspect where that comes into play and areas and aspects where it shouldn't come into play. And by the way that the Pew Forum is addressing this particular question, it would seem that our concerns would be seen in the same sort of vein as someone who would not be allowed to deconvert from their one religion. It would be seen in the same way that we do not think that religious schools should be publicly funded. You know, in an odd sort of way, those are both considered restrictions.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So, speaking of restrictions, we're restricted by time. And at the moment, time for us to have a bit of a break. Standing on a planet. Really, I'm
just a speck. I'm just a speck compared with a star. Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Free Thinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Free Thinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Today in the news.
And today in the news.
Today in the news.
Tired of the same few voices giving you the same point of view on the news? You're not alone. The Campaign for Democratic Media is a nonpartisan, nonprofit group fighting to ensure that our public airwaves represent more than just one voice. Canadians deserve diverse, accountable, and quality Canadian media. Visit democraticmedia.ca to learn how you can stand up for media issues.
And we're back. The Islamic bomb. Are y'all scared? Worried? Fearful? Well, as many of our listeners may have heard in the news for the past months, well, actually years, there's been much hand-wringing and belligerent statements about stopping Iran from getting the bomb. This fear has prompted a wide range of economic sanctions, including the rescinding of bank services like closing savings accounts to Canadian citizens of Iranian descent here in Canada. It's also one of the reasons cited for us cutting diplomatic relations between Canada and Iran. Israel and their supporters here in Canada and the U.S. have called for military strikes against Iran to, quote, delay its nuclear program. Now, I'm not a fan of the autocratic regime in Iran, and we'd be glad to see it replaced by, you know, this, it's a secular democracy. I mean, the pariah status of Iran isn't solely the result of these sort of scientific endeavors into nuclear power. There are a lot of other confounding issues, such as their involvement in terrorism, if it's true, which I think it is, with their support of Syria, their horrible human rights record at home. There's a lot of reasons not to like Iran. That said, though, I thought I would check out some of the justifications for this reaction to Iran based on these sort of claims of nuclear war mongering, and to see whether these, you know, were valid or whether we should be sort of skeptical of these claims. Now, the first reason that's given, really, is that, well, Iran is well on its way to developing nuclear weapons, that we need to strike, we need to do all this horrible stuff, because tomorrow they're going to develop the bomb or something like that. Now, the actual fact of the matter is that Iran currently has the capacity to enrich uranium to about 20%, and that's sufficient for a light water nuclear reactor. So it's, if you think, like CANDU reactor sort of thing. There has been some evidence that Iran can, more by accident than on purpose, increase that to closer to 30% if they really wanted to. Now, the ability to increase the purity of uranium via gas centrifuges becomes exponentially more complex as you increase concentration. It's one of those things, it's like panning for gold in some ways. It's easy to get the big rocks out, but as you get more finer and finer, finer grains, it becomes far more harder, far more laborious to get it out. Now, the uranium needs to be 90% to be considered weapons grade. Now, there are rogue nations out there that have achieved this, but they did so with a bit of help from the sort of nuclear club members. I mean, Israel is believed to have been helped by the British and the French. South Africa combined with Pakistan and Israel to help develop its weapons program with some underhanded help. They were working in England and they kind of stole some technology from there. North Korea is believed to have bought their technology from Pakistan. Pakistan used expatriates in the UK and financial support from countries like Saudi Arabia to build their bomb. India could not have become a nuclear power without Canada's help via our Cirrus reactor tech, which we sold them in the 60s. Of these rogue countries, though, only South Africa has actually signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. In fact, Israel to this day is in a state of denial about its own capacity. Ironically enough, Iran is a signatory to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. The point being, it's very difficult for a nation to jump from nuclear plant grade to weapons grade uranium, and none have done it yet without a sort of nuclear sponsor. That said, it is still possible for Iran to develop nuclear weapons, although there have been sort of some clerical errors with regards to their adherence to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. The AIEA, that's the International Atomic Energy Association, has found there's actually no evidence that Iran has ever really put forward on the ground nuclear weapons research. Now, there has been some talk. Iran did explore sort of the nuclear weapons option in the 80s, but all the work on that had stopped when it became apparent that such a program would be prohibitively expensive and not really achieve the security benefits desired. The USA's own National Intelligence Estimate Report of 2007 stated Iran had completely stopped exploring the weapons option in 2003. In fact, the only evidence that Iran has plans for nuclear weapons this century has come from a laptop that was obtained from, quote, reliable sources in Iran that apparently had plans for the deployment systems and high explosives necessary for nuclear projectiles. Now, of course, none of these claims have been corroborated, and considering the nuclear weapons claims that the USA has made about Iraq, most of the international community treats this laptop evidence with severe doubts. So it seems that on the one hand, you know, is Iran on the verge of creating nuclear power? Yes. Is it on the verge of creating nuclear weapons? No, not even close, maybe a decade away. And one could say, well, maybe it could approach, you know, one of these other partners for some support, the most likely perhaps being its neighbor, Pakistan. But then you get into the big issue that there's a war, in essence, between the Shiite and the Sunni sectarian groups, Pakistan being a Sunni group, Iran being Shiite, and it's not likely that there'd be any kind of collaboration on that one. North Korea is under such a lockdown because of its own stat, it seems like there'd be little interaction there. And I find it dubious to say that Israel is going to help them, considering Israel's the main protagonist. Have you heard anything about their ability to build the bomb?
You kind of mentioned that it's pretty difficult for us to take some of these claims seriously, given the sort of past record of predicting weapons of mass destruction in countries. So until Iran is demonstrating nuclear weapons, I don't know if there's ever really going to be slam dunk evidence, unless, you know, James Bond sneaks in and steals the plans or something, because I honestly don't know if it's even in Iran's best interest to have nuclear weapons and not make it known.
That's a line from Dr. Strangelove, I think, about the doomsday device. The whole point of having a doomsday device is that everyone knows about it. Keeping a doomsday device a secret defeats its whole point.
Exactly.
So another reason that's often given for this is that, well, Iran is a theocratic nation and is willing to use any weapon to destroy its enemies. However, this sort of goes in the face of its own thing. In that, I mean, they're a religious nation, so they take their religion quite seriously. So when the Supreme Leader, Al-Khamenei Khomeini, gave out a formal ruling against nuclear weapons, he said the Iranian nation will never pursue nuclear weapons, that it is essentially against the beliefs of Islam, and it's a dangerous thing, and they would never put it out there. Now, it seems that if they make it a fatwa that you can't do it, this might be, you know, if it was an American context, you say, yeah, maybe, maybe not. But the mere fact that this is actually a theocratic nation means that the fatwa has a hell of a lot more weight than you might normally give it. Now, in doing research for this, I actually uncovered something kind of interesting. So apparently it's okay for a Muslim, under certain circumstances, to lie and it not be sort of a sin. This is often raised to sort of counteract the fatwa I just sort of mentioned. However, the doctrine of taqiyya holds that a Shiite, for example, may lie about their faith if it would immediately save their life. Now, Shiites have often been the minority in their host country, and as such, more than once, they've been sort of asked to claim a fake religion or die. So this sort of allows them to claim to be a Sunni or a Christian without actually committing a sin. But there's always a catch-22 in religion. So that said, they could only use this under very specific circumstances. It was not really a license to lie. In fact, outside of the claiming false faith, they couldn't actually break the religious laws for their religion. So for example, saying you were Sunni would be okay, but if you drank wine, and the Sunnis of the Hanafi school are allowed to drink wine, you'd be damned and you couldn't do it. So it seems a bit of a stretch to say that, you know, that drinking wine would be a sin, but lying about nuclear bombs would be okay. So in an odd way, the fact that it's a religious country kind of adds credence when they come out and say, listen, honestly, we're not pursuing nuclear weapons. That being said, it's politics. Do you think politicians always tell the truth?
Well, given past evidence, I'd have to go with no.
Okay, so maybe we'll say that may be a weak point. And as I say, from a real politique point of view, maybe that one we'll put aside. But the last thing I'm going to talk about is that people say, well, Iran is a oil-rich country, so it doesn't need to pursue nuclear power at all. Now, Iran does have a lot of oil, but it lacks greatly in the ability to refine it. It's one of those resource exporting nations. I mean, we in Canada cut a lot of wood, but most of that is exported for further processing into finished goods. Also, Iran has a growing population with an increasing demand for energy. Iran lacks other export opportunities, and it's sort of extremely dependent on the money it gets from the oil exports. So it really wants to use as little of it as possible internally so it can sell it on the open market to make as much money as it can so it can buy the other things the nation needs to survive. Finding alternative sources of energy would allow Iran's society to both grow and modernize while maintaining, ironically enough, a low carbon footprint, assuming, of course, we ignore the fact that they're exporting oil. I should add, much ado has been made about the apparent threat by Ahmadinejad to wipe Israel off the map. Now, first of all, Iran itself has a no first strike policy, which has been, again, repeatedly announced by their supreme leader, Al-Khamenei. Again, but that could be politically, you could say, well, he might change his mind. Maybe true. But when Ahmadinejad expressed his hope that, quote, the Zionist regime over Israel would vanish from the pages of time, most people who've interpreted outside of the bubble of right-wing sort of bias believe that, you know, what was actually meant isn't that they're going to have tanks rolling down the streets and they're going to bomb Israel, but that they hope that the collapse of Zionism would be kind of like the collapse of communism, that it would fall under its own weight. It's important to note that Iran has not meant Iran has not launched any conventional wars of aggression against any of the states in the modern history. I mean, Israel itself has, you know, had a few wars where it has been the aggressor, Egypt and Lebanon. Now, Iran officially does not recognize the Zionist regime. So again, I'm not trying to get them off the hook on this particular one, which it does often quite equate to the state of Israel. Now, this is one of those confounding factors because as from an Arab perspective, the creation of the modern Israeli state was sort of seen as taking Arab land for European guilt, and that really the practical movement in Iran is actually to create a Palestinian state. They do use a lot of very verbose and aggressive language in saying that, but it should be noted that it's pretty much been limited to that sort of word war as opposed to physical war. That said, you know, all that given, that maybe, you know, there are some things going on, if Iran really was an existential threat to Israel, as Israel claims it is, again, why has there never been a war between the two nations? More realistic, perhaps, if Iran were to use nuclear weapons on Israel, it could have done so a long time ago, at least in the form of a dirty bomb. And as everyone says, you know, if Iran is so involved with the terrorists, which again, I think they are, they could have used these terrorist allies to sort of deliver these dirty bombs and made Israel essentially a nuclear wasteland if they were such a threat to Israel that Israel is currently claiming it is. Now, I don't make any bones about the fact that the tension between Israel and Iran is genuine. They are not friends. They probably never will be. But this second layer that seems to be put onto there seems to be more as part of rhetoric. I mean, one of the primary reasons Iran might want to get a bomb is if it were, I don't know, surrounded by nuclear-armed nations, like, I don't know, Israel and Pakistan. And if, at any moment, it felt like it may be attacked by another nation that had no fear of Iranian retaliation, I don't know, Israel and the U.S. In fact, many have argued that the biggest driving force for Iran to develop nuclear weapons is Israel itself and its continual threat of preemptive strike and the American doctrine of preemptive war. I know there's a lot to swallow there, Ethan. Any thoughts to add to that?
Well, if you're suggesting that the constant rhetoric of bomb, bomb, bomb Iran is having an impact on the national psychology of Iran, well, you might be onto something there.
So when we come back from this break, you might hear something deadly. Tune in after this break.
Science is the best tool ever devised for understanding how.
To subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes, subscribe via iTunes or at RadioFreeThinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@RadioFreeThinker.com.
Canada pays some of the highest cell phone fees in the industrialized world. And now the big three companies that control 94% of the market want us to pay more? Using high-priced lobbyists, the big three are trying to trick the government into shutting out independent competitors. If they succeed, they will squeeze more money out of your wallet and squeeze Canadians into tighter contracts. Send a message to the industry minister. We want competition. We want independent providers. Stand up. Sign this urgent petition. Visit stopthesqueeze.ca.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker here. So our next segment, we're going to be talking about some myths around the Black Death. Cheery show today. So we're going to talk about these myths. And if you haven't heard about the Black Death, here's a quick recap. The Black Death, a.k.a. the bubonic plague, was a pandemic that swept across Europe between 1348 and 1350. It is estimated to have killed between 30 to 60% of Europe's population, reducing the world population from an estimated 450 million to between 350 and 375 million in the 14th century. And it also took Europe about 150 years for its population to return to pre-plague levels. We're going to be discussing some of the ongoing mysteries about the Black Death. First, where did it come from?
Aliens. It was the demon Yagweth. No? Calusa?
No. Close, but no. There are actually several different theories about where bubonic plague came from. The most common explanation, and when I say common, I mean scientifically proven, is that the disease was spread by the Yersinia pestis bacterium. Now, the method of spreading the bacteria is still up for some debate. The generally accepted idea is that fleas spread the bacteria. The fleas would feed on an infected host, which would cause the midguts of the fleas to become obstructed by the replicating bacterium. This blockage would result in starvation and aggressive feeding behavior by the fleas in an attempt to clear their blockage. And this would result in thousands of plague bacteria being flushed into the feeding site, infecting the new host.
Glad I'm having supper.
Yeah. In addition, another source of infection would also be all the infected corpses laying around. All these dead bodies would basically be sort of like massive feeding frenzies for all kinds of different vectors that could spread the disease around. Now, at the time of the plague, the Black Death was believed to be caused by rats, specifically black rats, which were introduced to Europe from Asia. And that's sort of been the one of the possible ideas. We know pretty certainly that it was the fleas that were on the rats, which were the real culprits. But we're still not quite sure what exactly was the motivating factor for the plague to enter Europe. There are a few interesting theories. One of them is an overpopulation of marmots in Asia, which in fact may have spread the plague to the fleas and then to the rats and then to the humans. It could also be related to the movement and invasion by Mongol forces. It could also be related to earthquakes that actually forced large swarms of rodents out of burrows, which eventually would infect people. I don't know. What do you think of those, Don?
Well, you know, I think the Mongols get blamed for too much, so I'm going to blame the marmots on this one. Actually, you know, it's funny. I mean, you know, as human population grows, they were becoming more and more interlocked, and it seems that, you know, diseases do. They crop up from small locations. When those locations become interconnected with sort of the super highway of the day, it can spread super, super quickly. In fact, actually, from my own little research, and you might correct me here whether this is an accurate judgment or one of the myths you might be talking about, that the bubonic plague first became sort of evident in the plague of Justinian, the Byzantine Empire in the 6th century. But, you know, if things were not quite as well connected, so it had an opportunity to sort of die out as opposed to spread globally as it sort of, well, half globally, as it did when the Black Death itself happened about a century later.
Well, actually, that is kind of interesting because there are ideas out there that the plague actually visited Europe before Constantinople as well as Jerusalem. And there's actually some really interesting theories that tie in rat migrations and rat population growth, relating it to the disease spread. Now, that's pretty complicated, and I wouldn't say that it's universally accepted, but maybe we'll cover that for a different show. Let's talk about how the disease entered Europe. There is a relatively unconfirmed story that it was Italian soldiers who were defending the city of Kafka. They were infected there, and when they fled the Muslim armies into Messina in Sicily and then on to Genoa, they spread the plague into Italy. And this was in 1347. Now, by January of 1348, it had reached southern France. By June and August, it had reached Paris. And as early as 1349, it was in England.
Pretty quick.
Yeah. Scandinavia was devastated by the plague in 1350, and it reached the northern shores of Russia in 1352. Now, something interesting happened, though. While the plague spread through Europe like a hot knife through butter, it left some areas completely untouched. Now, why would that be? So, there were certain areas, specifically Poland and Milan, that were virtually unaffected by the plague. Now, one would wonder what could possibly have done this. And you can actually see some pretty interesting maps that show the progression of the Black Plague. And it does. It like circles around these areas. It's very strange. One rumor is that there's a statue in Prague of the baby Jesus that supposedly kept the plague from entering the city. Now, most likely, the answers are less magical. In the case of Milan, the government came up with a rather effective, if not gruesome, method. At the first sign of infection, the rulers of Milan would have the house of the infected, along with three houses next to it, completely walled up, with the people still inside it. So, not the best way to wake up in the morning to discover that you have the plague and you're also walled inside your own house.
Well, one problem I have with that, though, is yes, okay, the people are walled up in there, but the source of transmission is the rats. So couldn't the rats? I had thought actually when I was looking at some of your notes that you had given before the show, that they then burnt the houses down. That would strike me as being more horrific and more thorough.
They would. I mean, they did lots of. They had different methods. One of the things that I was uncovering is that it seemed to be that once the disease had entered the human population, it was being spread human to human. It could also have been spread, like I said, I mean, there were dead bodies laying around on the street. Europe at this time, they don't have a very good sanitary system. So there were lots of other ways for people to get infected, but it seemed to be that human beings were doing a pretty good job of spreading the disease around themselves at this time. Now, that works for Milan, but what about Poland? Well, in this case, the truth is pretty hard to come by. There are several theories, however. One is that Poland closed its borders to Europe during the plague. Another is that Poland was so underpopulated and that settlements were spread out so far that the plague couldn't really go through the country the same way. Another idea is that many Jews, who were often blamed for the plague, fled to Poland. And since the Jews were often isolated from the rest of the population, they had a much lower percentage of infected people. So there was, again, sort of less people around who had the disease to spread it around. Now, these may all seem plausible, but a few of these theories don't really hold water. For the first idea here, that Poland closed its borders is pretty unlikely. Nations in the medieval era didn't really have the ability to, quote, close borders. They didn't have a wall around the whole country, so, you know, they couldn't really run along the borders like they do in Texas. Now, cities, though, could do that, and in fact did do that. So in a lot of cases, the big cities, Krakow, Warsaw, Prague, would have these big massive walls, and they would have people with longbows on those walls. So if somebody came and they didn't want them in the city, they would just shoot them with arrows or send them on their way. So methods like that probably proved really effective.
Yes, I would imagine they would to a certain degree. And it does, I mean, especially with the your original sort of claim, actually it's not yours, of course, that the baby Jesus, I mean, that's funny. It's like in the Polish context. I mean, the weird implication, of course, of that is that everyone else, like the Pope, was somehow less religious than Poland, which is why, you know, God spared them, but said, screw the rest of you.
Well, I mean, we all know the Pope was pretty corrupt. Drunk. But those Prague people, I mean, they were true believers. The other thing about the ideas that Poland sort of escaped this was the notion that it was really underpopulated. But in actuality, that wasn't the case. Poland was as populated as most other European nations at the time. So it's pretty unlikely that Poland was somehow bigger or faster or more desolate than, say, France or Germany or any other nation. So it's also unlikely that it was simply because Poland was poorly populated. Now, in reality, the truth may never be found because records from this period are very elusive. And since there was no real idea of how the disease spread, finding the right information from primary sources is incredibly hard to come by.
Actually, one of the theories that I heard, and this is often used to explain why we think of the Black Death as one sweeping movement, but you know, the bubonic plague actually had several reoccurrences over time, right up to, I believe, the 1600s. And each time it hit, it had a much lower mortality rate. It was still scary, but it was not seen quite as bad. And one of the beliefs that this happened was, again, evolutionary effect, that some people were sort of naturally, not so much necessarily immune, but were less likely to die from it. So when the first wave hit, everyone who was going to sort of die from it died off. Those who had a minor or major resistant lived on, their children lived on and reproduced, so that each time sort of the plague hit, there was a diminishing sort of mortality around it. And it's conceivable that this sort of genetic anomaly that allowed them to survive the plague in the first hit may have been present in something like Milan or in a population in Poland. So they kind of had a built-in natural immunity just from the randomness of genetics.
Yeah, that's entirely possible. In fact, the mortality rate was about 70%. So, I mean, there would have been a number of people who would have gotten the plague and survived it. And in a lot of cases, when that happens, you do incur some immunity from a secondary infection, and that could have been passed on genetically. In fact, there may also have been other factors at play here. I was reading that some university cities actually were able to weather the plague quite well. For example, Oxford had a far lower mortality rate, comparatively speaking. So maybe cities that had people who were a bit more aware of, I wouldn't say science or anything, but perhaps were just a bit more careful, perhaps a bit cleaner, perhaps the city was a bit more sanitary. All of, like, a whole bunch of little things could have added up and created minor patches of immunity on a map.
Quite possible.
Right. So the final myth here to address about the Black Death is a nursery rhyme, Ring Around the Rosie. Now, what would this have to do with the Black Death? Well, let's take a listen to the rhyme that we're most familiar with. It goes like this. Ring around a roses, a pocket full of posies, ashes, ashes, we all fall down. Now, the myth is that this creepy-sounding nursery rhyme is actually a reference to the Black Death. And it began in 1347. The ring around the rosy refers to the red round rash that is the first symptom of the disease, the practice of carrying flowers and placing them around the infected person for protection is described in the phrase a pocket full of posies, and the word ashes is a corruption or imitation of the sneezing sound made by an infected person, and we all fall down is referring to the infected person dying.
Well, we do know that, you know, they did believe in, what is it, miasma, that, you know, disease was carried in the air. And so the pocket full of posies, you know, a nice fragrant flower, that would have some credence.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, plague doctors used to wear those weird masks with the long extended snout, and it was full of, like, crushed up flowers because they believed that, you know, there was this kind of ether-like infectious cloud that was floating around. However, while this explanation does make the rhyme even more creepy and kind of cool, it's actually not true. While the references are valid, the rash, the sneezing, and the death were all attributed to the Black Death, the first recorded use of this rhyme is dated to 1881. Now, for the plague origin to be true, we'd need to assume that children have been reciting this continuously for over five centuries. Meanwhile, no one found the time to write down this incredibly popular rhyme. In addition, there are several more variations of this rhyme that have appeared around 1881 as well, including the version, Ring around a rosy, a bottle full of posy, all the girls in our town ring for little Josie. Now, even if we assume that it was true that this rhyme was a plague version, how can we be sure that the plague version is the real version and that the other variations are not corruptions of that one, not the other way around?
Doctor Who, where are you?
Yeah, exactly. Now, additionally, not only were children reciting this plague-inspired nursery rhyme, but it also took over 600 years for someone to figure it out, because it wasn't until 1961, in a book called Plague and Fire, that a connection to the Black Death was even proposed. Thoughts, Don?
Actually, you know, it shows how culture plays into it. And actually, ironically enough, you know, the fact that this tune came out in the 1800s, the Ring Around the Rosie part, is how much of history is dependent upon, you know, when it was written down, when it was created. The Victorians are famous for creating out of whole cloth complete traditions that, you know, are supposed to be historical, go back to the beginning of time. But there is no other evidence other than one day some Victorian said, oh, yes, we've always been doing this, and it's come up. This sort of a plague angle just adds a lot of interesting insight into, you know, how history itself can be so completely malleable based on whoever happens to be writing it down at the time.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the fact that the rhyme's origin are indeed the 1880s, but the association with the plague is really recent. I mean, the funny thing is just how pervasive that idea is. I've heard it repeated many, many, many times. And just when I was doing research for this, I found no shortage of sources claiming that this is absolutely true, that Ring Around a Rosie is a direct reference to the Black Death. In fact, it's also been claimed that Ring Around a Rosie also refers to the English plague of the 1600s, and I'm sure many other plagues as well. And again, the supposed references, the sneezing, the all fall down, pocket full of posies, you know, I mean, they're pretty vague. They can apply to almost any disease that was going on in that time frame. So most likely, absolutely, total myth.
Yeah, and actually, if you think about it, language itself, right? I mean, the 1400s, they've been using Middle English, at least Middle English, and not Modern English. So even the word structure would be completely different.
Absolutely. Well, we're out of time here on Radio Free Thinker. So why don't we go to our skeptical highlights?
I've got one skeptical highlight this week. Beneath the Sands of Egypt. Wow, sounds impressive. It's a lecture that's happening Thursday, September 27th, 6:30 p.m. to 8:30 at the Alliance for Arts and Culture Center. That's 938 Howe Street in Vancouver. You will listen to, or get to listen to, a lecture given by archaeologist and Egyptologist Donald P. Ryan, who will share some of his discoveries in the King's Project. The project itself was the excavation of several of the smaller, little-known, decorated tombs in the Valley of the Kings, some of which, of course, are revealing some fascinating surprises and controversial mummies. So, for example, did they find the mummy of Hespet? Is it a relative of Tut? Were there mass graves? So if you're interested in history, archaeology, this could be just sort of a fun night out. You show up.
Sounds good. Okay. Well, my skeptical highlight is the CFI Freethink Book Club, which is coming up on Saturday, October 13th at 1 p.m. The book they're reading is The Panic Virus, The True Story of Medicine, Science, and Fear by Seth Mookin. The Panic Virus is a really interesting book chronicling the anti-vaccination movement, everything from Andrew Wakefield, but in addition, how the sort of myth of vaccines and their relation to autism got spread around by irresponsible media, as well as some pretty corrupt politicians and basically special interest groups. And it talks a lot about how the fear and the sort of miscommunication of science to the public all combined in sort of a perfect storm. It's actually a really interesting book, talking a lot about the hubris of science and how really we can honestly blame ourselves for not being great communicators of how science works and explaining things properly to the public. It's actually a very challenging read, so I encourage you to check it out. You can find copies at the Vancouver Public Library, as well as in bookstores all over Vancouver. And again, meeting Saturday, October 13th, 1 p.m. at the Grind Coffee Gallery on Main Street here in Vancouver.
Oh, Ethan, I forgot. I have one other sort of skeptic highlight for the week. Oh my God, how could I have forgotten this? You know what happened last week?
What happened last week?
The Ig Nobel Prizes were awarded. So check out the Ig Nobel Prizes. It's improbable.com/IG. Some really, really hilarious and yet thoughtful research projects. Tune into our next week's episode where we're going to go over a number of them just to get you acquainted with what is bizarre in the scientific community.
I'm already excited about that.
Excellent. So this is Don saying, eyes open, minds on, tune in next week.
This is Ethan, your freethinking historian, saying, thanks for listening. See you next week, folks.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Freethinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.